Thank you, Emily, and thank you for inviting me here for a week. It has been fun to chat with you again and discuss new projects with Ribhu. So all three of us, I guess, have a Duke connection, so it was fun to sort of catch up on time. But still, I wanted to talk to you a bit about the work that I have done in the last, I would say, 3-4 years. It's been sort of work ongoing. There's still some work to be done. And then I wanted to sort of give you a sense of how this work is coming together with another kind of idea that I have been thinking about, which I call qubit regularization of quantum field theories, which I think some of what I'm going to say is most likely very straightforward to the condensed matter community, but I think from the lattice field theory community, it's been a pretty interesting set of developments, I would say, over the past decade or so. Let me give you a bit of motivation of where I'm coming from. The work was actually motivated by a couple of people from Bern who work with my collaborator there, Uwe Jens Wiese, and they were thinking about conformal field theories, and they had come up with a very interesting idea of calculating critical exponents in some of these well-known conformal field theories like the Wilson-Fisher fixed points. And they called it the large charge expansion. And then they said, maybe can we try to check or predict, understand if their predictions are correct. So that's how the motivation started. So if you think about conformal field theories, the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, there are sort of quantities which we call conformal dimensions, which I will use as DQ in general, which come from insertions of certain field operators that we insert in the conformal theory, and they have dimensions, and their dimensions is what we would like to compute. And the way we usually do that is to introduce an operator which has the charge Q. This Q will be the charge that will tell me what operator I'm putting in. And then when I compute the two-point correlation function, typically on a conformal theory, there is no scale. So it decays like a power law, and the exponent there, the way I define it, it should have been 2dq, each one has a dimension dq. So that's how you usually expect this to go. The goal, of course, is this dq, of course, depends on the conformal field theory, and it sets, it is given by certain quantum numbers of this operator, which I label as q, and it's interesting to calculate them in these conformal field theories, and it's very hard to do that. Right? There are no small parameters itself in three dimensions when we try to compute them, and so it would be interesting to figure out how to do that. Of course, there are lots of perturbative methods that have already been introduced in this field to compute them. So one is the epsilon expansion. There are certain other calculations people do which doesn't quite work for some class of theories, but for others it works fine. There are certain large N expansions that one can do, and you can imagine many others perhaps. There are, of course, non-perturbative methods, and which is what my field of research would be, basically bringing maybe some kind of Monte Carlo methods to compute them, and that is very well known and developed, especially for the Wilson-Fisher fixed points and these ON kind of models. And of course, there's a whole new revolution in bootstrap that is going on. So I would say there is the proposal that Orlando and Suzanne, which came to me and asked, is that they believe that they had a new expansion called, they call it the Q expansion, called the large charge expansion. And then some work was already done at that time. And then the question was, what is the, what do they do? They start with some kind of a conserved charge in your conformal theory. Let me call it as Q. And then they ask themselves, can we go to sit right at the conformal point in, let's say, an ON model, and then ask if Q is made very, very large, what happens? Is there some simplification that occurs? So if you try to compute the conformal dimension associated with the lowest charge operator that induces the charge Q in this theory, is there some simplification in the large charge sector? And then they say that, in fact, if you use some the idea of radial quantization and basically try to compute energies on spheres, we should be able to obtain what dQ is in this large charge sector, because there is a way of doing a semi-classical expansion, the theory that you write down, an effective field theory that you write down in the large charge sector at the conformal point, actually is possible because the charge is distributed in on your sphere, and it introduces a new scale in the problem, which is basically the density of these charges. And so then one some kind of a semi-classical approximation becomes viable. So that is their idea. And using that, they actually predict that for the ON models, if you compute this d of q, it should have a very simple expansion. The leading power is q to the 3/2. The next power is q to the half, and so on. The c naught is, of course, some calculation that they have to do, which involves some kind of an exact calculation that involves something similar to an anomaly. So that can be actually done completely, and you get a number for that.
What's the q they have taken for this one?
But, pardon?
What's the q they have taken for the ON?
Yeah, not for the ON. I'll explain to you how they do it. We'll talk about two different examples. This is just a generic thing, so we'll talk about some examples. So the leading order term can actually be understood pretty easily if you think about it. So the way it happens is you're in a conformal field theory, and you need to know a bit about radial quantization of how one does these calculations. And in that formalism, you can actually show that the conformal dimension is actually equal to the energies if you define the theory on a sphere of radius 1. So if you compute energies using your effective field theory approach, and then you ask what is the energy of the theory, the ground state energy of the theory, you will actually compute d of q directly. Now, if you just know that, you can actually do a very simple dimensional analysis, and you can say that suppose you are having a sphere of radius r, right? So you've introduced the scale in the problem, that's r. The energy you compute is E of R, and that E of R will be related to the energy density times the surface of the sphere, right? And then the charge density itself is related to Q by 4 pi R squared. That's the way how the charge is distributed uniformly in the sphere. Remember, you're doing a semi-classical approach, so in some sense, it's just some simple dimensional analysis argument. So then the physics insight actually comes in the fact that it's the energy density is proportional to the charge density. And so if you think about the mass dimensions of these two, that's exactly the way the two should be related. And in that, from that, you can actually show that dq, which is basically the energy at r equals 1, should scale like q to the 3/2. So that's sort of the simple analysis you can actually do. Of course, if you really want to know beyond that, you will have to do more calculations, which I will not get into, and it requires a bit of effort, which I have not done myself, so we will have to believe them. But from our perspective, what we wanted to do was, they have a very simple expansion in terms of expansion in terms of q to the 3/2 and q to the half. The coefficient C3/2 and C/2, which I mentioned to you, are low energy constants in their effective field theory. That is something that they cannot compute. So maybe a Monte Carlo could compute for you, and then it would tell you how the expansion works to the small q.
So is there any simple argument for the second?
For the why is it 1 over q? It's just an expansion, remember, is 1 over q. So that's all it is, nothing more than that.
Okay. And Shailesh, can we do, so these coefficients depend on n also, right?
Yes, they depend on n.
So they have plotted expansions for the coefficients?
Yeah, so that's something that they've done recently, I think. that they actually compute that coefficient in the large end limit. Yeah. So of course, from our perspective, if you want to compute d of q and check this expansion, you will need to calculate d of q using Monte Carlo. And as q becomes large, remember d of q becomes large. And so, for example, in the O2 model, Carl, you asked me, in the O2 model, the operator is pretty straightforward. All you have to do is to introduce q charges. And so, for example, even in the simple model, if you wanted to compute this for large q, which decays like x minus y, 1 by x minus y to the power, again, I keep using dq. It should be 2dq from my definitions later on. So it's noticed that this will decay rapidly, right, as q becomes large. Although it's a power, it decays rapidly. And so if you did the traditional kind of a method, you can start seeing that this will fluctuate quite a bit. You're averaging quantities of the order of 1 to get something which is small, which is going to be difficult. So that's one of the challenges that you have to do. By the way, if you can use some kind of old traditional Wolf-type algorithms, and then you'll see that even then, going to large dq becomes hard. It's not as easy as you would like.
I have a simple question.
Yes.
This dq depends on the operator.
Yes.
Itself, right? So is the statement that dq starts as q to the 3 halves in the large q limit for any operator with charge q?
Yes. That's the leading...
And so the coefficient c, 3 halves, c, 1 half are depending on the operator itself.
So it depends upon the quantum number. In that quantum number channel, that will be the leading primary operator, right? So as Carl pointed out, in the ON model, you'll have more charges, and so you'll have to work on it carefully. So I will talk about that in a minute. So of course, things can be more complicated. This was O2. It was just one charge. So for example, you can ask what happens in the O4 model, and this was another thing that we did more recently. In that case, the O4 is related to SU2 cross SU2. So in a sense, if you think about representations of O4, now they are represented by two numbers, right? They are spin half, spin one, depending on what QL and QR are. And so in each of these sectors, you can create an operator, right? And if you create it in the lowest, depending on QL and QR, there is a primary operator in that particular sector. And any operator, it'll have a projection into that lowest primary operator, and that's the DQ you will get in that operator. So, for example, you'll have to figure out how to create an operator with a particular QL QR sector, right? Based on your theory. And then if you look at the two-point correlation function, it'll decay like 1 by x minus y, again to some power d, which depends on QL and QR. This will be the challenge to figure out. Of course, if you take the traditional approach to the O4 model, you will start with a scalar vector, right? A phi x, which will have 4 components. And it's a vector, so it naturally lives in the half-half representation. So from that, you will have to create operators. So take kth power of it, if you wish, on the same side. And then you'll have to do your Clebsch-Gordens and figure out how to project it to the right sector. And so it requires quite a bit of work, and it makes it difficult, right? So the challenge from the Monte Carlo perspective is, can you find a way to compute this D easily? So that was how we got involved into the project. So clearly you see that there are some new ideas. If you just use the traditional approach, you can try to push the boundaries, but it would be much nicer to think about new ideas. So this is how we got into the game, and we said maybe there are some new ways of doing it. And I would say in the past decade or so, new ideas of doing or formulating field theories using what we call dual variables has become very popular at least in a subset of the community. And so we would like to bring that technology to this and see what we can do with that. So these are what are called world line formulations. And then from that, we realized that there is even simpler type of formulations, which I call qubit formulations, which are very useful. And especially with this new pot of money that is coming up in the US with lots of applications to quantum computing, maybe these formulations are very useful to useful to these researchers. So let me motivate you from that. So let me focus on the O2 model and explain to you how we do the calculation in that, and then I will explain the O4 model later on. So this was done a few years ago already. So the idea is if I try to start with the traditional model, I will start with the usual XY model, which has been studied to death many, many years ago, where on each site a phase, you define the model with a phase, right? On the other hand, in the mid-2000s, there was a new way of thinking about this model from the Monte Carlo perspective, so they can actually do an exact mapping of this model through what are called these current loop models, which is actually very familiar in the condensed matter literature, where one can actually rewrite the same model using, instead of variables that live on the sites, you can make the variables live on the bonds, and each of these bond has an integer label, right? And then you update the integer label and you figure out what to do. So the world line approach allows us to efficiently create and annihilate charges, right? So for example, if I have to put in a charge, I just have to insert a charge on some site, and that'll just increase one extra Q on one of the links, and so it will be like a defect in the configuration. So here, there is a U1 conservation law that says that whatever current comes in has to go out in terms of these integers, but then a defect is like creating an extra charge. If you want, you can create 20 charges. It's not a big deal to do. That would have been very difficult to do in this language because it's like e to the 20 theta, right? And then it rotates very quickly, and then when you do the calculation, it leads to lots of complications. But here, there is no such complication that comes in. In fact, if you introduce a chemical potential of this Q, this formulation has a sign problem, whereas this formulation doesn't have a sign problem. So that way, you actually solve the sign problem very easily in this approach. So the partition function with Q insertions of the sources is exactly the same as before, except that there is current conservation on all the sites except for two sites where you put a source and a sink. So pictorially, the lattice looks like this. There is I'm doing it in three dimensions. So think about some space on a time slice, and then this is L, right? And then you introduce a source there, and then you can introduce Q charges there if you wish. And so there will be an extra defect with Q charges sitting there. And then you will put the sink far away, right, at L by 2. And then there will be all these have to go and end up there. So you have to sample all configurations based on these weight where there is a source and a sink. And that's the way you do the calculation. Now, these algorithms, which originated in the condensed matter community, actually allows us to do these calculations very efficiently without a problem. So, and if you calculate what ZQ is, this is the partition function with Q charges, in a conformal theory, you can argue that at very large Ls, even on our lattice, we should see the 1 over L to the DQ scaling, right? And so one can actually take ratios of two of these partition functions, and then that ratio will scale like 1 over L to the difference in these DQs. And so that's how we actually measure this. So the way we would measure this is we would go in steps, right? So we will have no sources and sinks, and then we'll put one source and one sink, right? That will be e to the I theta correlator. Then we will have, we will sample correlation functions of e to the 2 theta and e to the minus 2 theta, starting from e to the 1 theta and e to the minus 1 theta. So we always sort of go in steps of 1, which is easier. Otherwise, going from 0 to q is hard. And I'll show you that that's pretty stable. We can get good results from that. OK, so these are our results. So I'm plotting ZQ by ZQ minus 1 for small q, 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And we can go to very large lattices. This is about 1 over 100, so 100 lattices, right? 128 lattices. And of course, for really small lattices, sometimes you see corrections to scaling. But as soon as you go farther away, everything starts fitting well to a simple power, right? We don't even have to add corrections to scaling in this case. And we can all go all the way to, for example, you have 8, 9, 10, 11, right? So there's a lot of, we can go to very large charges and actually compute all these delta, the differences. And from those differences, we can actually compute the real thing. So here is the calculation that was done, in fact, many years ago. Already people used this Wolf cluster algorithm to compute it. Hazen Bush is a veteran in that community. This is Q equals 1, 2, 3, 4. These are the epsilon expansion calculations. I'm not sure what this is, actually. To be honest, I forgot. But these are the Monte Carlo results, right? And that's the bootstrap. And so everything seems to be in agreement there. So the question is, what do we find? And so these are our results, and we can go all the way to 12. And we can just extend all these. And these are in agreement with what people found in the first four. But then we actually find that we can go to much larger queues very easily. Right? So this allowed us to really measure this D of Q. And we should ask if this is how well does the prediction do. So that's the question that...
So just technically what you do is you just know what the critical temperature is, and you study the correlation.
Function at that critical point.
The plot you showed with the power law.
Yeah. So these are all at the critical temperature. This is what you're saying, right?
You don't do any collapse.
No, you don't have to do collapse of what?
I mean, there are different ways.
Oh, to calculate the critical point, you mean?
That's done separately.
Yeah, that's done separately. In fact, that has been done already for this model by that Hazen Bush group. So people know that very accurately, right? In fact, first we ran it in a not very accurate way, and then Hazen Bush told, hey, you should take it at the point where I know it three more decimal places more, right? So I said, okay, we'll do that. So that has been done fine. So all we have to do is to sit there and then do this calculation.
There's no modification to X1. This is exactly the XY model.
Right? This is just the XY model.
The cosine.
Yeah, this is the cosine. This is the traditional XY model. It's just that I think if I did it with the Wolf algorithm, maybe Hazen Bush has some trick, but I would have thought that going to large charges would be difficult. Right?
So delta Q is from epsilon expansion.
Pardon?
Delta Q in your table is from epsilon expansion.
This one?
Yeah.
No, this is exactly what we measure. Remember, these are the differences.
Yeah, so two numbers. One is delta Q, the other is DQ.
Oh, the reason is because we measure this, and this is measured by sort of this, and then this plus this is that. This plus, this is that.
Oh.
Remember, you have to go in steps of one, and we make that up. Right? Yeah, these are all independent calculations, so we can just add the errors in quadrature. That's what we did. So how does the Q? Yes.
Is this extendable to higher dimensions? This is all two dimensions, right?
Two plus one, three dimensions.
Three dimensions.
Yeah. This is Wilson-Fisher fixed point, remember? Yeah, so it's in three dimensions, yeah. So we can do this in four dimensions if you want. Three dimensions is more interesting. So how does the Q expansion do? And this is where we were actually surprised, very surprised, I must say. That's the result, right? So their prediction was that if I, it's an expansion in Q3 halves, Q half, right? And then this is that analytic number that they can actually calculate. This was their prediction. These two numbers they cannot calculate from their effective field theory approach, right? So this data, if you fit, if you really take into account the errors, I think you have to drop, I think, the first three points here. Only then the fit really works well. But that's because our error bars are really, really tiny, right? But then if you just drop these three or I think something like that, the fit really works beautifully, but then notice that I can't even see the error at that scale, right? So that's how the large Q expansion works all the way to Q equals 1.
Can you remind us how did they do the analytic calculation for constant? Was the physics argument for why it's possible to calculate that and not the other coefficients?
Yeah, that's a quantum calculation. It's something to do with an anomaly. We should talk about it after.
So the correction is beyond this also, right? So
in fact, to be honest, this we cannot really fit very nicely. We just choose that because it's known, right? If we fit this, I think we get 0.07 or 6 with an error of 3 or something like that.
Okay. So that's the exact number, is it?
Yeah, this is supposed to be the exact number. I think the first calculation they did, they got it wrong, and then somebody corrected them, right? So it's a subtle calculation. This is like, yeah.
So naively, this formula will work if when Q is large, but
yes.
Your results seems that.
Yeah, that's the whole surprise. So I would have expected that it would have been like, and then slowly drifted there.
Yeah.
Right, but it seems to be perfectly fine.
Okay.
So the next term is 1 over q to the half.
Yeah, 1 over q to the half. That we, yeah. Okay. So now the question, of course, this was a few years old. Then the question was, can we do all this in the O4 case? And the O4 case is a bit more interesting and challenging because, first of all, there are two charges to think about. And then there are different sectors in JLJR sectors, right? And so can we do something there? Now, of course, the first step would be to just take the O4 vector model and write it in the dual representations, right? And this has been done. There are lots of work on that. I should have maybe put some references there. I'd be happy to tell you what the references are. There are lots of other researchers who have done this already. However, think about, I already mentioned to you, if...
What is the traditional dual representation of the
O4? It's not the traditional dual representation. There is a traditional model. Oh, I said, I should say the dual representation of the traditional model.
Yeah.
Right?
So what is that?
So that's basically, actually there are many ways of doing that expansion. It's basically what I told you, right, going from theta to current loops. So here there are... there are many ways of writing that kind of current loop models, and people did that. Uli Wolf did that in the first case for ON models in general, and then Christoph Guttringer and company did it in a slightly different way. There are different ways of doing it. Either you write it as an ON model, or you write it as SU2 cross SU2 for O4, right? There are many different ways of doing it. But in any of these ways, you can easily imagine that if I want to project out the JLJR sector, it's a bit non-trivial, and also there are radial fluctuations because the O4 vector can go from one sector to the other sector, right? If you think about as a vector representation, it involves certain continuous variables that you have to update, which can lead to a lot more instabilities in the algorithm. So we thought, is there another way to think about the O4 model which will maybe help us do the large charge expansion the way we want to do it? But then it'll be simpler, right? So that was the reason I will tell you that there is a much simpler approach to the O4 model. Again, something that I'm sure the condensed matter community would know about, but I think from the lattice field theory community, it's an interesting, simple observation. So before I do that, I want to sort of step back and talk a bit about the way I think about these new developments, which I call the qubit regularization of QFT. So typically, we already know that when you define a QFT, you need to regulate the theory in some way. And for many, many years, we have been regulating it on the lattice, right? But maybe we can do one more step and define them in a slightly different way. So whenever we regulate QFTs on a lattice, we start with defining, especially the bosonic variables, we start defining them with the conventional or the traditional canonical formulation where you have phi and pi are the conjugate variables and you write the usual commutation relation among them. And that already requires you to have an infinite dimensional space at every lattice site. So x and y are lattice sites here. And so when I think about a bosonic variable on that lattice site, which satisfies that relation, I have to work with an infinite dimensional representation. And that's the traditional formulation of lattice field theories. On the other hand, we could define maybe a qubit regularization where we say, no, we are not going to live with the infinite dimensional representation. We are going to change this commutation relation, and we are going to say we just want a finite dimensional representation on each site. And can we still get the same physics of the traditional lattice field theories that we talk about? Do they have the same continuum limit and things like that, right? That's an interesting question to ask. And I think we know for some infrared critical points, this can actually be done. This is just RG. But then it'll be interesting if it can be done for all kinds of quantum field theory. So that's a question, I think, that needs to be thought about. But it's important to remember that for fermions, we don't have to get into this trouble because they already have a finite dimensional representation, except that they anti-commute. So that is an interesting question to think about. But at least from the dimension of the Hilbert space, it's still finite dimensional. So maybe they are slightly simpler in that sense. So Wilson's RG, of course, tells you that this should in principle be positive. So if you think about the space of all possible couplings, and then on a lattice with maybe formulating in qubit regularization, right? That's one model of a qubit regularization. There's another model of qubit regularization. Suppose there is in that whole theory, there are quantum critical points. I just tune them and get into some kind of quantum critical point that allows you to get to the infrared fixed point at that point. So if that point has a relevant direction, we should be able to probe that physics by studying this qubit regularization. That's sort of the goal, right? Of course, this is a cartoon. It's not clear if all theories can be done with qubit regularization. So that's actually a challenge. So in fact, one of the challenges, can we really get Gaussian fixed point, which are asymptotically free in this way? I think it's a, we proposed, my collaborator Uwe Jens and I proposed that this should be possible using what we call the D-theory approach, but it's not clear that everything will work out. So that's something to think about. But clearly, this should be at least of interest, I would say, for the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Even there, you have to sort of do some work to calculate where these critical points are and what field theories you get to. So if I write down a qubit regularization with all the symmetries, I still have to do that extra work to make sure that I get back the real physics. Or is it flowing to another fixed point that maybe we have not yet thought about? So that's a question for our community. So of course, all this was known long ago. I would not say these are all new. It's just that I think to study them, as I told you, are non-perturbative. You need non-perturbative you need Monte Carlo algorithms or some other non-perturbative method, which is not very developed at that time. But now we have a lot of new ideas and lots of new phenomena are being discovered in the condensed matter community. So I think there is an opportunity for both the communities to come together, and maybe we will have new ways of formulating theories and maybe some new algorithms to solve them. So that's sort of the goal, and that was what we proposed many years ago. and it's also interesting that all of this is coming together with this new pot of money where people are trying to do this with quantum computing. But nobody really thinks about in this literature about how to get continuum limits. Can you really do quantum field theories? And that's, I think, an interesting question to ask. So anyway, in my talk, I'm not going to worry about all these sort of more exotic things. In my work, I'm just trying to see if I can do a large Q expansion and see what happens, right? So let me tell you how we regulate the O4 model in this qubit way. So the idea, what we started with is, let's start with something very simple. So let's start with four hardcore bosons, right? And then write down the Hamiltonian using them. So this is the Hamiltonian that I would work with, right? So there's a typical hopping term. So each of these hardcores can hop around, right? From one side to another side. So this is like a nearest neighbor model on a square lattice. So remember, I'm in 2+1 dimensions. So this is just a two-dimensional Hamiltonian, right? And then I have what we call a pair creation and pair annihilation operator, because I'm doing a relativistic theory. So I'm allowed to create these bosons in pairs or annihilate them in pairs, right? And then I have a chemical potential that tells me whether I want to have bosons or not in my system, right? I could deplete the whole theory without having any bosons, or put the system with many, many bosons in, right? So that's my theory. That's the thing that we ask. Now you can easily show that this theory has an O4 symmetry, because I can just rotate this with O4 and that with O4, right? And both of them are invariant. You might say this is actually U4, but it's not, because this term will break that. It only preserves O4 for you. So this is a very simple model. So on each site, there are actually five states. So it's a five-dimensional Hilbert space per site. So there is a state where there are no particles, which I call the Fock vacuum. And then there are states which I can label as vectors, the O4 vector. And I will label them as QL, QR. In a minute, I will show you how we do that. So remember, there are going to be many indices, so I just want to be careful here. So when I write JL, JR, I talk about a sector, right? Remember, these are representations. In each JL, JR, there are 2 JL plus 1 times 2 JL minus, times 2 JL, JR plus 1, right? There are so many more states, right? These are all transformed under the O4 symmetry, right? So these are in the half-half sector, but then there are four of them, right? Two here, two there. So these is what I label them. So pictorially, I would call the vacuum as what we call monomers. These are the Fock vacuum. And then these will be the particles that will travel in my world, right? So I label the four states based on their QL, QR charge, Z component of the QL, QR charge, as with up arrow or down arrow, red and green, right? So these are the ways you would label them. So remember, red up is half-half. Green up is half minus half. So the first QZ is exactly the same, where that changes. Right? That will be helpful to build my sectors later on when I build my operator. So this is a picture of how the thing will hop, right? So here the red up arrow is hopping. Here the red down arrow is hopping, right? Here's a pair creation, pair annihilation. That's how the thing will work out. So I can formulate this, although I start with the Hamiltonian, I can formulate it as a lattice field theory, and this is what I'd like to explain to you how that happens, right? And this is, again, technology coming from the condensed matter community. So you start with your Hamiltonian, and you divide it into H1 and H2. H1 will be the chemical potential term that will just tell me how much each sort of world line as they travel costs energy or not. H2 will be either a hop or a pair creation event, right? So I just expand it. And I don't remember, this looks like some kind of a perturbative expansion, but it is really not. You can actually convince yourself that if I allow for all possible k's here, then you're just doing the whole theory exactly. And so this way of doing lattice field theory was not quite popular in our community, so I think it's a useful thing. So, of course, I can now discretize this integral in terms of sums, right, and introduce a lattice in time. And so then epsilon will be the lattice spacing, and I can actually get a relativistic limit if I set epsilon to 1. I'll show you in a minute. And so there are, so this is how the picture looks like, right? So particle, these are all vacuum states. There's a particle getting annihilated and created, right? There are green particles. And so the weight comes, the temporal bond weights come from this term, right? And that's like exponential minus epsilon mu. And the spatial hops come from just the hops, which comes like epsilon times c, right? And now if I make the spatial hops the same as the temporal hops, notice that this theory suddenly becomes rotationally invariant, right? So you have a model which looks very Euclidean, but it is a representation of the O4 model, at least from this qubit regularization. So it's a very simple model of an O4 field theory. Of course, we don't know if it will really produce the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Most likely it will. And how do you do that? You just have to make monomers more likely than these loops, right? So clearly, there's a phase where the loops are all very unlikely, so there are no particles, so it's like the massive phase, right? And the other phase, when their loops are sort of proliferating, that will be like the broken phase of the O4 model. So instead of working in that language, we just, in the relativistic limit, we can just set WS and WT to 1 so that the loops don't cost any weights. We just weight every monomer with a U. This is another sort of way of writing this whole game. So the first thing we did was we wanted to see if we can actually see the O4 symmetry, all the features of the O4 model. So we defined two order parameters. One was the susceptibility, which is basically creation and annihilation of these particles, right? And then sort of integrating them in all possible ways. And then there is the winding number, because we have a conserved quantity, right? The particles don't, there's a symmetry, O4 symmetry, so we can actually compute the winding number separately. This is related to the superfluid density, if you wish. So near the critical point, you expect sort of the usual critical scaling to appear, and then that should be nu. That's eta, and these are the critical exponents. And our model, we can really go to large lattices, and then we can predict where the critical point is, and everything scales according to this relation, and we can predict what nu and eta are. Now, if you compare with the literature, that's the best calculation that was done in 2002 using the traditional O4 model. And so indeed, we reproduce what we expect. Of course, this is not perhaps surprising, but now we have a way of using this model to do our large charge expansion, right? It makes it easier. So what are the large Q sectors? Now, I already mentioned you need JL and JR, and how does JL and JR come about in this model? So we have to, first of all, we can choose any of these sectors. Remember, for every JL and JR, there are many values of QL and QRZs, and I can choose any operator in that space, right? And because of O4 symmetry, all of that will be the same. So DQ will be the same in that whole sector. We can actually prove that even analytically. So again, going back to our approach, right? So we will introduce an operator here in that sector, annihilate it, right? Source and sink, and do exactly what we did before. So again, the scaling will depend on this D. The algorithms will allow us to calculate the ratios, right? And the ratios will be these differences as before. So the question is, how do I construct operators of this type? And let me explain to you in the next few minutes I have how we do that. So first of all, remember that I cannot take a single site and add a lot of charge there, because it's hardcore bosons. I have either a vacuum or just one particle, right? It can only be a vector. So I will need to spread this out. So what we do is we take some location and then we spread out the thing around it. And we can also try, in fact, Debashish tried it in a different way. So he put everything in a box rather than like this, right? And we made sure that we get the same answer in the two ways. So we introduce some source, right, in a spread out way at zero and sink in at L by two. And now in each of these sites, I have to introduce either a red or a green, and we chose to introduce a source like as though they were going up in time, right? Or coming out of that point. So this is like a defect, and that defect will live in one of these sites, right? And then it can be either a red defect or a green defect, right? So at t equals zero, we have this, and at t equals L by two, this will go and merge. So it will be like the creation and annihilation event at half. But so we have to construct some JL, JR sector by using these two. And that's easy, right? Now we just have to use our usual SU2 Clebsch-Gordens to do that. So for example, the highest weight QQ sector is very easy. So we create sources of the same particle, right? So suppose I take half, 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 half with all the two Q, that will have the biggest charge. So that will be JL is Q, JR is Q, and then this is QLZ and QRZ. That's the highest weight. So we put that here and put the sink here, and we measure the correlation function. That's QQ. We can also measure other sectors, but that needs a bit of work. So for example, if I introduce one green and all red, that will have overlap with two sectors, because now the JZ part of the R, the L is of course Q, but R has become one less because it canceled. So there'll be two sectors that it'll talk to. So I'll have to do some linear combinations of these to get my projector. So the simplest example would be the Q equals one, and there we have to, this will be the the source with the largest Q, but that will be the source with the next Q. So you see, you already start seeing that there are negative signs that come into the game, right? So we have to have a careful cancellation of certain contributions as we measure it. So these will be slightly more noisy, so we haven't done that, so that's like ongoing work. So I will show you results for the QQ sector. So here, for example, I can easily see that if I introduce sources and sinks like that, the highest weight will be positive, right? The next weight will be the negative. This is the usual. And now this is something we have to do for large Q, and we can, that's something we are actually doing. Now, what are the predictions from the QFT? And here, perhaps I will give you a sense of how they do the calculation, right? So for the O4 model, you start with an SU2 G, right, at every space and time. But then you want to put the space on a sphere. Remember, you want to calculate things at a given, on the sphere at R equals 1. But so they'll write down an action, which is interesting from my perspective, but this is sort of standard in the literature at the moment. So this R is the curvature that comes from the manifold. DG is this object here is just the usual kinetic term. The reason why you raise it to, I think I made a mistake, it's 3/2 here, sorry. Because I want to make these coefficients dimensionless. So that's the way you write it. Right, so. Yeah, this is the 3/2 part, and that's exactly what then if you do the calculation, you get the Q to the 3/2. And then given an action which is SU2 cross SU2 invariant, you can write down the Noether charges, right? And then you can look at a sector, you can parameterize G in that sector in a careful way. And then you assume that there is the leading order calculation is just a uniform thing. You have to make an ansatz of what the ground state looks like, and then you do a semi-classical expansion about that. Right? So it's just basically doing fluctuations about that background field in each charge sector. So that's sort of the way they do the calculation. So the prediction is slightly interesting here. When JL and JR are equal, you get exactly as again I have typos here. Sorry, it's yeah, this is fine. So this is. J cube is absorbed here, so J to the 3/2, then this is 1 over J, this is 1 over J squared, and that's your E naught piece. But then when JL is not equal to JR, they can even do that calculation, and this is a bit more interesting. You get the same coefficients. This is the subleading term, right? And notice the subleading term, again, depends on C 3/2. And here, this difference over the maximum JLJR is actually small. That's sort of the prediction, right? So they have a complete prediction of how this is going to happen. And so the question is, can we check this? Now, of course, in the first project we did, we just computed the C 3/2 and C 1/2, because once we have this, in principle, all of this is known, right? We can actually see what happens. So the and it's important to remember that this next correction piece, because JL is not equal to JR, does not introduce new low energy constant. Right? It's exactly the same. So that's more predictive than what we thought. So once we know C 3/2 and C 1/2, we should actually be able to compute both of these pretty accurately. So let me tell you how what we get. So we again use the worm method to do these calculations. So here again, we have some sector for the J minus half sector, right? Remember, all our reds going up. And then we introduce one more, right? So we sort of find that ratio. And these are our results. So this is for small j's, 1/2, 1/3, 1/2, and so on. And again, we go up till about 100 square lattices, 100 cube lattices. And it's pretty reasonable. Again, everything worked as before in the O2 model. And using this, we can actually compute the deltas. And so using the delta, we actually compute the DJJ here. So for example, again, Hazan, Push, and Vikari have computed this up to J of 2, right? And our numbers are in good agreement with theirs. And then we can go up till much higher J's using our ideas. Question is, how does it do in the O4 case? Right? So again, it's a very good prediction, and now we get this to be slightly different, that to be slightly different, and that's what we get. So this is a pretty good agreement with what the prediction says. So it's pretty surprising. So I just wanted to tell you that the O4 model, of course, we did in this way. Since I have a couple of minutes, let me just tell you that O3 model is, again, very simple in the same way. All you have to do is to now use four singlet and a triplet, right, as before, and just use the same Hamiltonian. And we have actually checked that we get exactly the same results as before. Again, the formulation is very similar. Now, instead of having two colored loops, we have one loop and sort of one unoriented loop for the O3, if you wish. These are the charged loops, and this is the neutral loop. So from the physics of pions, this is like a neutral pion. That's like a charged pion, if you wish. And again, you have you can do calculations, and so these are some things that I've already mentioned. So this is again well known O3 model, and in this model again everything fits fine, and we get very good agreement with results of the past. Right. So this is so it shows that we really don't need a full realization of the infinite dimensional Hilbert space for bosonic theories. We can actually do it with a finite dimensional representation space. Of course, the more interesting question in my point of view is whether we can get asymptotic freedom in this particular way, and this is something that would be interesting to explore. Of course, in 4D, since the Gaussian fixed point is irrelevant, that is, you can easily get to it, all the directions are irrelevant, it's easy to see that, but when you have a relevant direction, it's a bit more work. You'll have to tune yourself, and that's something that we would like to understand better. By the way, in the D-theory approach, this has already been done in some models, so it'll be good to see if you can do it in other ways. Okay, so let me present some conclusions. So I hope I've convinced you, at least using two examples, that the Q expansion for the CFT seemed to be working well, at least for these ON type of models. That'll be interesting to explore if they also work in other theories. So in fact, there are some recent work on Chern-Simons theory also that came about, I think, just a couple of months ago. So it's interesting to see if this will be a way to understand some, at least some classes of CFTs. Another sort of side that I hope I have convinced you, that often when we do traditional lattice field theory, you might have a way of computing quantities differently using simpler formulations, which I call these qubit Hamiltonians, which is of course very common in condensed matter physics, but from a field theory point of view, the goal is that if you want to do computations in a quantum field theory in general, can you start with any, so you give me a favorite quantum field theory you want to study, can I just convert it using a qubit approach, right? And that's very natural for quantum computation if you can really formulate the problem that way. And so maybe we should think about what I call qubit regularizations.
Questions?
So Mr. Stefan, who is sitting next to me, we did the 1+1 dimensional O3 model.
Right.
And there has been one representation. This is a disaster.
Was a disaster?
It's a disaster.
Okay.
We had to go to at least 4 to really make contact to continue.
That's useful to know. I see. So how do you have any similar? Is your Hamiltonian sort of similar to our Hamiltonian at all, or what? Is it exactly the same, or no? It's exactly the same. Okay. Okay.
This is neutral.
Yeah, useful observation.
I was surprised that it works in your case, and for us, it's really a disaster.
Yeah. So this is what I think is this question of asymptotic freedom, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So this is fair. Yeah.
I was wondering, I didn't know very much about 3D CFT, but the degree to which these large cube expansions are correct, even for small cube, does this suggest there's something like vertex operators going on, like there are in a free boson 2D CFT? You have a compactified free boson 2D CFT, you have a set of primary fields and they're distinguished by their charges under a U1 charge. And there's a simple relation between the conformal dimension and the charge. And could it be that something like that is happening in this 2D CFT?
I wouldn't be able to answer that. So you're using what we found here for 2D. You're thinking about 2D CFTs now.
I'm trying to make
a connection.
2D CFT. That's all. It's based on how well this large cube is working.
Yeah. So my intuition for 2D is much less because all of this is being worked out in 3D. But yeah, as for example, I think there may be. Yeah, it's not yet clear. I must say.
I was wondering if you knew anything.
No.
I really don't know much about status research. That's...
Yeah, no, I don't think people have been thinking about 2D QFT in this particular approach, but maybe it's useful to think.
So have you tried to compare this in your O3? So you just assume that you can do the calculation.
Yeah, we haven't done any calculation, that's fair. So O2 we did, because O3 again will have only one charge.
Yeah.
So we assumed that it will work out. So we directly went to the O4. I was just sort of curious to see how O3 worked out in this particular approach, because just to be sure everything is in the same thing. Yes.
Just wanted to ask a clarifying question. So when you did your Monte Carlo simulations, the conformal dimensions were computed essentially using correlators, right?
Yes.
And so this was with a toroidal topology?
The lattices are all toroids, right? So it's like periodic in space and periodic in time.
Right.
And then you make the system larger and larger, and you control the finite size effects. Right? You use the finite size effects essentially to sort of imagine in your mind that you just have one scale, and this is like the probing scale of the theory, right? And then you just ask yourself whether the usual scaling of that scale is reproduced.
So this was measuring a two-point function, like scale half the system.
Exactly.
System sizes. Right.
Okay. Right. So you put a source and a sink at half, exactly at the midpoint.
Right.
And then you make the systems bigger and bigger. So this should sort of go down, right? Exactly. That's exactly what we do.
Is a finite effect becomes more severe if Q is large?
No, actually they become smaller because remember they're higher dimension operators.
Yeah.
So in a sense, what is severe is to compute the number, but once you compute the number, they seem to be fine.
Okay, I see.
Right? So it's like it's only affecting a small region. So in a sense, maybe that's why you're able to do a semi-classical calculation, in my understanding, right? So the physics is coming from a smaller region somehow, right? And you're, as long as you get sort of the mean values right, you're able to do the physics. That's my intuition. But once you, from our calculation, maybe what we are learning, you could say, is that you don't really need very large systems to do these kind of things at very large Q, because semi-classical works. Right? It's like, maybe that's my intuition.
Somehow, my intuition is different.
It's different. Ah, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? All right. Let's thank Travash.
Thank you.